Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth, straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden, and I'm working at...
An Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage, as parents, for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
And welcome, everybody, to the Chuck and Julie Show, the Chuck and Julie Grassroots Show, Truth Straight Up. That was President Trump calling. No, just kidding. I'm Julie Hayden. Chuck had some meeting stuff that he might be able to join us a little bit later, but I kind of doubt it. He has some meeting stuff he couldn't get out of. Taking a bit of a break from local Colorado Republican politics right now. I'm going to talk about some kind of big national issues and some fun issues, too. So we're happy to have with us Greg Robidoux. He is an award-winning filmmaker and commentator. I want to talk about what the heck is going on at Disney. Hey, Greg, welcome to the Chuck and Julie Show, and thank you for your time.
Oh, my pleasure. Welcome. Thank you, Julie.
So we've been kind of watching because my daughter watched the Snow White and we've watched the Disney princesses and things like that. And, you know, I don't know what they were thinking with Snow White. This has been forever in the making, millions and millions and millions of dollars. Why don't you kind of like, in your estimation, just how much of a disaster, both financially and PR wise, has this Snow White remake been?
Oh, wow. Yeah. So almost unthinkable, but in my mind, very predictable based on what they've been doing in the last few years. But they had an operating budget for the film, Julie, of about $272 million. And the way Disney works is if they're going to put anything, once they break a threshold of about $250 million, they start projecting that for the movie to be successful in their perspective, they need to make about at least $100 to $150 million upwards, because you have a lot of back end costs as well. You sometimes have deferred payments. You have other distribution, post end marketing costs. So the goal isn't just to make $5 million or $1 million. I mean, it's to make some decent money from their perspective, especially if you're putting that much amount of dough. Well, they're on track right now. Even if I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt, they're probably going to lose at least $100 to $125 million. That's
wow.
How big of a bomb it is, right? From a PR standpoint, you know as well as I do, they've been sort of mucking things up now for a number of years. And I'll tell you right now, I'm not a big fan to begin with of going from classic animated, which I see as the real magic of Disney, you know, the real classic world of make-believe, to live action. I mean, Lion King, cute. Even some of the scenes that were a little scary, it's still make-believe. I took my nieces and nephews to it. They got a little scared, but like they knew it was make-believe. Seeing a little bit even of the live action of like real lions tearing each other apart, they were terrified. And that's not uncommon to go from that to that. So to go from Snow White to classic, 1937, phenomenal movie, it was a landmark, groundbreaking film in so many ways, script and color and animation technique and sound effect and music and voiceover advancements that they had in 1937 to today, live action, where they changed and modified and went woke with the script. They had all kinds of bad karma, bad decisions with the dwarfs. I mean, first we were live and it was sort of a rainbow, diverse DEI dwarfs, and then it was CGI generated, then it was back to live, and then it was back to CGI generated in a live action film. To the co-star, Rachel Zegler, who she barely, you know, signed her name and the ink was barely dry on the contract, and she started bashing the original. Making fun of it, saying it was like the prince was like a stalker and who even cared about that anymore. And she never even liked it. And then she starts bashing and tweeting F Trump and his supporters and may no peace come upon them and may harm only befall them. So she upsets and basically turns at least half the audience or more that probably would be best suited to watch Snow White. Quite frankly, because it's more family, like you were saying, with your kids' family, more conservative, more family-friendly, family-oriented. So right away, you're bashing more than half the audience that might see your film. And then the day the trailer comes out, which in the distribution is launch point number one, it's a key date when you get that first film trailer released. And then she picks that day to go on social media and to reinforce how much her support for Palestine and Gaza and association by association Hamas is, when her co-star is Gal Gadot.
Yeah.
Gal Gadot as in Wonder Woman, Gal Gadot as in Israeli-born, Israeli Armed Forces former person who stood alone, it seemed, in the wilderness of Hollywood after October 7th, saying, hey, who's going to stand me against this atrocious attack on Jews and anti-Semitism? And Rachel says, hey, she's my, you know, my mentor, I'm her protege, and she picks that day to essentially bash her mentor. So from a PR, it was a great question, because it's not just about the money. It's
right.
about the long-lasting image and brand of Disney.
Well, and it seems to me, you know, again, like as my daughter's grown up now, but Disney, they had a brand, right? I remember Little Mermaid came out. So Little Mermaid comes out, we all go see Little Mermaid. Then we
right.
buy Little Mermaid dolls. Then
oh,
we buy Little
yeah,
Mermaid
of course.
Pajamas, right? Then we buy Little
yep.
Mermaid books, so Little Mermaid. So, I mean, Disney had this brand.
Exactly.
And then after
yep.
that, then it was whoever was next. You know what I mean? And
yep.
they had that, you know, then Elsa, right? Everyone walks around singing Let It Be or whatever it is, right? And you have little Elsa princess costumes. And I mean, and that to me was a brilliant brand when you get right down to it. And what is going on at Disney that they thought, let's take an enormously successful brand and totally crush it to the ground? I mean, what I would think if you're a stockholder, or is it just that this wokeness sort of trumps everything?
No, it's a great question. And I think part of it, there's a couple parts to it that I kind of analyzed. I think one
okay.
big part of it is, okay, one big part of it is that Disney has moved away from what you were just talking about, what made them so successful. The kinds of programming, the kinds of films, the kinds of animation and stories that aren't out to score political points. They're not out to advance a certain political agenda or narrative. They're to do what Disney's vision was, which was entertain and make as many people as happy as possible. That was his vision. It sounds simple, but if you do it successful, look what happens, right? An incredible company, an incredible iconic brand is born. So you start moving so far afield from that. Plus, on top of it, do you know that Disney didn't make a sequel or a remake until well into the 1990s? Because Disney's
uh-huh.
vision was keep it fresh, keep it original.
Right.
So
right.
now you start cranking out these live action, essentially remakes of the classic animation. You mentioned Little Mermaid. Little Mermaid, the animation, was huge success. Really low budget, made a couple hundred million for them, plus all the wonderful merchandise you mentioned. The live action loses $160 million. Mulan, animation, huge favorite, huge success. Live action loses $210 million. So it's bad strategy, I think, to just keep trying to roll the dice on these live actions, because not everything animated works and translates well into live action. But it's also then you start beating your audience over the head with a certain message, and instead of going to where they are, you're like, mm-mm. We're going to essentially, through our characters, tell you what you should be thinking. We should tell you how to live your life. And we should, and we believe through our characters, we should make points about what you should be teaching your kids. And
right.
that's when it starts to backfire. You know, you start hiring people that think a certain way, that have a certain agenda, have a certain narrative. I've watched videos, to be honest with you, and I've listened to some folks in the industry I'm close with in film that are closer to Disney. And, you know, at night we'll chit-chat, we'll talk about shop and the industry and all kinds of stuff. And they'll say, look, for quite a while, Disney was going out of its way to hire people that felt exactly the same way on social issues. And then these folks would come in and they would boast to each other about how they're going to put, you know, essentially an agenda into every single animated Disney or any kind of program they can get their hands on. And so then if Disney green lights it, Julie, you're playing these things and you're putting money and you're building these programs for a fraction of the audience that Disney wanted to entertain.
Yes. Well, and let me ask you this, too, and I don't want to get back to the film, but just I was thinking about this earlier, you know, when I was kind of reading your column. You know, there was a time, I think, when celebrities, I think people maybe paid attention to them. But in this social media TikTok age and thing and, you know, YouTube age, everybody's got their own favorite influencer. And so,
right.
You know, we have not only do I have a grown daughter, I have a 14-year-old son. If you were to say to him, George Clooney, he wouldn't have a clue who you were talking about. But if you were to
right.
say Odd Ones Out or something like that, right, he totally knows. And I think that I don't even know why actresses like Rachel Zlotnick, I never even heard of her before she did all this, right? I think that they're it's all in their head anymore. I don't think they have nearly as much influence again because people are able to pick their influence, so to speak. I mean, what do you am I right, do you think, or what do you think of that?
Yeah, no, I think you are. You know, a few years ago, I wrote this book, and I was doing a ton of research for it. It's Hollywood Politicos Then and Now, and it was just on this subject. Essentially, do these celebrities really have the influence, the pull they once had? And when they go out off camera and use their social media platform or their fame or being a celebrity for something they think is good or what they believe in, does it hurt or harm or have no effect on the film or the product? Basically, what I found was time after time after time, it's not going to shock anybody, but what I found was that it hurts or harms it because people then start thinking about, okay, that's not George Clooney, the character. Oh, that's that George Clooney. Oh, yeah, didn't he write that New York Times op-ed that really pushed Joe Biden? He wanted to push him out of running for a second term. Or, oh, yeah, that Brad Pitt. Oh, yeah, didn't he come out and blast Trump? And isn't he involved in that terrible divorce with Angelina Jolie that seems to have, like, never ended? Or you have a number of these things, right? Well, I'll give you an example, quick one. Tom Cruise, for a few years. It was, oh, yeah, Tom Cruise, isn't he part of that crazy Scientology? Well, guess what happened? Tom Cruise and his PR team realized that he was going overboard about his beliefs. And essentially they said, Tom, you're going to be in these huge MI, Mission Impossible projects. I mean, we're talking billions of dollars at stake. We don't want you, essentially, if they knew about Rachel then, they would have said, don't pull a Rachel Zegler.
Yeah.
You be Tom Cruise, the action star, and let people believe in that. And then you do your thing off camera, but not in front of the camera, and don't do it where the public starts thinking of you as the Scientology guy. And if you notice, for the last few years, not a peep. He doesn't talk about it publicly at all. So what do we think of Tom Cruise now? Oh, that's that cool guy. He's doing all these incredible stunts with helicopters and motorcycles and Halo jumping and, you know, 1,600 feet from a plane. We're not talking Scientology. And in the old days, the studios used to handle these stars. They I don't know if you knew this, but it was on the lot of Paramount. They used to have a special area that by a door that was unmarked. And nobody knew, essentially, unless you were the stars. And the stars would go into this room. They'd have basically, it was like a hidden big apartment, and they'd play cards and drink and do whatever the heck they wanted to. Huh. And no one would know about it. So then when Humphrey Bogart was in front of the press, you were, oh, yeah, that's Humphrey Bogart, the Maltese Falcon guy. Oh, he's so cool. He's such a big movie star. They didn't know his politics. Now, social media wasn't there, but they got the message that, hey, you screw things up, you're going to lose money forever. Because people are like, oh, what's the impact on Rachel Zegler? I think I worry more about what's the impact on a lot of other people whose jobs are at stake when a movie bombs.
Right. Well, and you know, and we watched, and that's a good point, right? I mean, all the movie theaters, the kids who work at the movie theaters, the trickle down effect is huge. And I gotta wonder about movies in general. I mean, we watched a little bit of the Academy Awards. I mean, and I saw Dune, which was nominated for something, but even my daughter, who's fairly liberal, she was happened to be here that night. She's like, I never heard of any of these movies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, no one did. And what do you think, are they, again, as the wokeness ends, are they starting to get the message? Or have somehow, has somebody decided, oh, money doesn't really matter anymore?
Well, they better not think that for long, Julie.
Yeah.
they'll be out of the business, which might be a good thing in some of these studio cases. I think with the Academy Awards, so from as a filmmaker perspective, you know, I have a project right now. okay? That was an original script I wrote, and I've shopped it to some producers. They love the script, and, you know, it takes a while, but we're trying to put a deal together because as a film director, it's my dream to direct this film. Now I got to start thinking, okay, if I tell the story the way I want to tell it, it probably won't be eligible for any kind of Academy Awards, even if it's Dream of Dreams. It's the, you know, it comes out so great because I'm not meeting a certain criterion of what they're saying I have to meet. So this last year at the Academy Awards was one of the first years the new criterion, sort of a DEI-driven, went into effect. Right away, 126 films that were made that year, last year, were not eligible to be considered for Academy Awards.
They didn't check all the boxes, right? Yeah.
Right. So when you see films like Anora or The Brutalist or some of these films, you can go, even the Demi Moore vehicle to try to push her into an Academy Award substance, you start going, who watched these films? I mean, they have their moments, but are you really telling me that Anora or The Brutalist is Academy Awards of like what you and I grew up on? I mean, epic, sweeping, incredible films?
Right.
It's hard. So part of it's that. And then I think part of it is like in Disney, you've got Bob Iger, second time around as CEO. Well, he's facing FCC investigations for some of the practices at Disney and some of their DEI stuff. And he's also, Disney's facing just the fact that they can't sustain bomb after bomb. They don't have unlimited money. You made an excellent point early on when you said, don't they have shareholders? They sure do. So they got customers and they got shareholders.
Right.
So at some point, you've got to maybe pump the brakes a little and say, look, it's not like we want to go out of our way to ignore any people or certain communities, but how about we get back to just first and foremost saying, what kind of story can we tell that's compelling, entertaining, fits with the classic Disney magical brand that people love,
right.
instead of, that's not important, let's push this agenda and then we'll see if it's successful.
Well, and let me ask you this too. So I was in TV. I was a TV reporter for 30, 40 years, longer than I care to remember, in Denver. And I was not that long ago, and it was somebody's goodbye party. And they were talking about that, and we were kind of joking, but kind of not, that you could foresee a world of the not too distant future where you didn't really have a human anchor, right? You would have an avatar, like my son picks for his video games, right? And if you wanted a blonde female anchor, you could. If you wanted a whatever talking monkey, you could have that. I mean, you could pick your own avatar. And I would worry, I mean, you know, like this racial zeller, I mean, you know, of like, why deal with her when you can create an avatar? I mean, is that too far out? I mean, to me, that seems like, I think it'd be terrible on some fronts. And yet I could see that you don't have to worry about any of that, any kind of actresses making goofy comments if they're an avatar.
Well, if there's such a push now, in some ways it's a plus, in some ways as someone who, you know, spends some of my late nights and early mornings writing and trying to be creative, or with some of my crew working on storyboarding or sets, and we love it, but I mean it can be very draining. So one part of AI can take care of some things that maybe aren't as creative, but what worries me as well is that AI is becoming so pervasive, and we're almost going out of our way to make ourselves obsolete, which I never think is a good idea. But one of the trends in movies is to become more like video games, where you and I, let's say, and could go, or say with your, you know, with the kids, even though they're older, and go to a movie, and then we could program before or with an app in our phone. And we can program the film essentially to have different ending or different avatars or different characters that we prefer pop on a set of glasses. And we're sitting next to each other, but we're watching essentially two different movies.
Right. I was going to say, and I think what happens is, again, I watch my son who, I mean, he plays video games. So he's, to me, when I watch it, you can kind of tell like, what was that? That Christmas movie with Tom Hanks in it. To me, I always found that kind of creepy, the AI generated right?
Yeah.
But that kind of stuff doesn't bother my son at all because he's used to seeing that kind of thing, right? And and I just kind of wonder where that, I mean, I don't know. There's a part of me that was, if I were an actress, I'd be kind of like, how do I help promote this movie now? As opposed to, you know, why do I want to tank it and my career? And like you said, the job to somebody. Do you think the studios are going to crack down on that, or can they not? Are they, would they be unwoke?
Yeah, no,
to do that?
They are. I think more will to your question. More will. Disney tried to, believe it or not, they tried to towards the end. They started to finally get the memo from people that she's really hurting projected box office. She's souring sort of the pool of potential audience members before the film's even out. And then once it was released, you know, it's really too late to do much about it. But right before it was released, they sent a couple people from PR in New York, flew them out to LA to try to have a sit down with her. I don't know how much good it did, because when I checked as of 2 days ago, most of the tweets that she had put that offended people were still, she hadn't taken them down. So either she or her press person, I can't believe anybody worth anything in publicity would go out of their way and tweet that on behalf of their clients. Right. So I got to believe it was her. Other studios are beginning to write it more into the contracts. So
yeah. To me, that
if
makes
I
sense.
Hire
yeah.
you and cast you as my star, it's like, this, you're, let's say, you know, you're Penelope, my star, and until X amount of time or 3 months past the release of the film, whenever you post anything, do anything, interact with the public, you're Penelope. And so that's all you're going to, you know, somebody says, what do you think of Trump? What do you think of Jasmine Crockett? You're like, I don't know, because I'm Penelope. So I really just talk about the lovely film.
Well, and that wouldn't even be, again, when I was in TV, that was part of the contract, right? And it was vague enough so that if you did anything or said anything they didn't like, they could fire you.
Really?
You knew that. Yeah. I forget what the term was. Chuck, who can't be, he would know, he's a lawyer. But yeah, no, that was clearly in the contract. I couldn't go say whatever I wanted, wherever I wanted, or whenever I wanted. No, I had to
get
permission.
Are you talking like an NDA? Are you talking like a non-disclosure agreement, an NDA?
No. It was a sort of a... It was clear in the contract that as long as I was employed by the TV station, I was essentially... at all times sort of a representative of the
representative
station.
Of that. Exactly. Yep.
And it was sort of a professional code of conduct kind of thing or something. Mm-hmm.
And that's what used to happen back in the day. That's what used to happen with the big three or big four studios. But then when that broke up in the 60s and 70s, you started to have all these kind of more independent, which for me, people like me, great. There's more film opportunities we can make and more streaming services and hopefully more opportunities to get people to watch our film, but not great from the perspective of then actors began to see themselves totally as free agents representing nobody but themselves. But again, if you step out and you push it too far, it reflects back on the product, which hurts everybody associated with the product. And then the residue of negativity or bad taste on the brand doesn't go away with just the next movie. I mean, it really tends to stick. Think of all the work and vision Walt Disney and his brother Roy did for decades to build it, and think of how fast you can destroy it with this kind of an experience.
Well, let me, you've been wonderful, Greg. This has been so fascinating. Where can people, so you make movies, where can people see your films? Where can people read your stuff, find out more about you?
Oh, yes. No, I appreciate it. They can go to gregthefilmmaker.com or visit more of our film studio website, which is this Valmar films, valmarfilms.com. Always looking for feedback, collaboration projects, working with other folks to tell stories through film.
All right. Hey, and then next time when we watch the Academy Awards, we'll be like, hey, we knew him when we had him on the show. So, Greg, thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Julie. Take care.
Thank you there, Greg. Greg Rabideau, guys, you can go to velmarfilms.com. And Greg, the film guy, he's got kind of a fun website. I was checking it out earlier. Coming up here in a few minutes, we're going to have John Conlon on. Hey, and I guess, Doug, if you want to go ahead and call John early, we could do that too. He's going to talk about some education stuff. A couple things, though, I wanted to briefly talk about, and that is, and we'll be talking more about this too. So Trump is talking about tariffs today. It'll be interesting to see how that all works out. And once again, the Democrats are like, and even some Republicans, well, guess which, the Rhino Republicans, are like, oh, the economy is going to crash. Even I saw David Harsanyi in the Washington Examiner, which is owned by Phil Anschutz, is saying, oh, well, what if Trump is wrong on the tariffs? Well, okay, you know, when somebody has a headline like that, that in about a week, he's going to be writing, oh, told you Trump is wrong about the tariffs. And I like David Harsanyi, but it's kind of like, you know, I mean, you can read whatever you want of that. So we'll be keeping an eye on that. Oh, great. Doug got John. So we're pleased to have with us now, John Conlon. He's a frequent commentator we have on the show. And once again, John, hey, thank you for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And John, I'll let you know, and other folks are just joining in. So Chuck had some meeting stuff he was hoping to wrap up, but I think it's not likely he's going to. So today it's just me. But I loved your column in The American Thinker, and I was thinking of this today because we're getting emails from my son's school where they're preparing for the, I think it's the CMAS test, whatever that stands for. It's statewide standardized testing going on again. And you had a great column, public school teachers, the stupidest people on the stupidest creatures on the planet. Tell me about that. How do you come to that conclusion?
Well, I wanted to be subtle. That was my first goal.
Yeah. I was going to say.
No, I got tired of yelling at my TV when crap on the would be happening out there. It's like I live in Littleton. They're tearing down the middle schools and elementary and building new ones. And I'm like, wait, all you ever talk about is how you're broke. And I was a management consultant in like the for-profit world. And it's like no one ever said, oh, I need to tighten our belt, so we're going to tear down our building and build a new one. And and there's just a river of money flowing by teachers, and they constantly cry about how they're underpaid. And it's like, well, haven't you ever heard of opportunity cost? Maybe you should be out protesting these buildings being torn down and saying, hey, why not give us half the money and the citizens could keep the other half and, you know, everyone wins.
Right. But instead, well, and not only that, what they were protesting, did you see the teachers did it? And I talked to some annoyed parents who had to, do some quick daycare scheduling because the teachers, I think Adams 12 and most schools, a couple of weeks ago were closed. All the schools were closed in a day because the teachers are going to go protest at the state capitol for more money. I'm like, right. That's a way to win friends.
Exactly. And it's like, well, what is your unions doing for you? So I have no sympathy for you if you're going to be that stupid. We can argue about whether they're underpaid or overpaid, but, you know, if you just accept the premise that they're underpaid, it's like, what is your union doing there? There's a river of money flowing by you in every way, shape, or form. Number of administrators that are exploding, the buildings, just money everywhere, and teachers stand by there and bleat, oh, but I'm underpaid. Well, you know, step to the plate. If you have a union, do something about it.
Right. Well, yeah. And I think, and we've talked about education before with you too, and you have just so much experience with the topic, but it's like, it's a mess, right? In the meantime, you want to get paid more, but you know, the test scores are down. I mean, there's some in Illinois, you know, my sister lives in Illinois, and in some of the Chicago schools, like I was reading a thing where at some of the schools, like literally none of the third graders were reading at grade level. And it's like, well, now granted, I know it's not all the individual teachers' fault, but that's part of it, right? It's like, well, the product that you put out, so to speak, is students. And when you look at what students can or cannot do, then that should be tied, I think, to what you get paid as well.
Oh, right, exactly. Well, and that's another article that I had written about the school choice movement, right, which would address that 100%. If we gave people the money that is spent already to educate their kids nationwide, it's $17,000 a year. In New York State, it's $33,000 a year per kid. give that to those parents in some type of regulated environment and watch the world change. And all these teachers would make a lot more money. They'd start, because there are a lot of good teachers out there.
Right.
You know, I mean, it would change the world. But that the title of that one was originally Republicans Couldn't Sell Pussy on a Troop Train. Once again, trying to be subtle and insulting them. It's like, how hard is it to go to poor people and say, look, I have this check for $20,000. I want to give it to you to educate your children. Support
right.
me. I don't think that's a tough sell.
No. Well, and nor would it be all that hard. Like you said, you wouldn't actually give the parent the actual physical check.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
Not.
You would have to tie it so it went to education some way, shape, or form. But and it seems to me that then that would sort of solve the pay problem itself. So, for instance, there's my son's charter school, right? They do a great job there. And they're growing, right? And they're building all kinds of new stuff there because they have way more kids coming because they're such a good school. And at a certain point then, now they're making more money. They're making more money. So now they can pay the teachers more. I mean, to me, that just seems sort of like that's a business. That's how the business world works, right?
Right, exactly. That's the way reality works.
Well, and why is it, do you think, that education and teachers, and is it the union or what is it, that those concepts are separate anymore?
Going back to that article about the teachers, one of the reasons that it's also the stupidest creatures on the planet is they've allowed their personal interest to be taken over by support for the Democrat Party. So a lot of that is this is just, you know, they blindly follow the tribe regardless, even though the results that the tribe's getting are pretty poor.
Right. Right. Well, and I think it's hard if you're a teacher to stand up against the union, right? I mean, we talked, and I know people who are conservative teachers, and they're like, you keep your mouth shut, right? And they're forced it. But you're right, it's because of the union leaders and the Democrat policies. I think a lot of teachers would be happy just to go teach and not have to worry about that kind of thing. Well, how, in terms of, you know, I guess, like I said, they're doing these statewide tests. And it's kind of interesting because on the one hand, the schools emphasize, make your kids rested, make sure they come to school, et cetera, et cetera. Even though they're incredibly stupid and all they do are they don't really tell you as a parent, and you try to say, well, how is this? What's this measuring? And they're kind of like, well, nothing, actually, you know, because there's so many factors. Do you see stuff like that going away, or does it have a value, do you think, in terms of sort of a broad national or at least statewide testing? Or,
well, once again, if we brought freedom into the system, it would solve the problem, because right now the problem is these are government schools. This is all government run, and I support public education, but that doesn't mean that the schools have to be run by the government. But that means all these other tests and everything, of course, who are you going to cater to? Your customers. Well, they're government schools. So, where'd you come from? Government schools. So it's very incestuous where if freedom and competition came into play, it would solve all those things. You know, you and I wouldn't have to come up with a solution. Trust me, the marketplace will come up with a solution just like it does everywhere else.
Well, and what I fear, too, is so then they look at so they do their own measurement, then they're underperforming. So then I think there is a tendency to throw more grants or more government money at it as opposed to, so now we need even a bigger and bigger Department of Education.
Right. It's like welfare. It gives them a perverse incentive to get more people on welfare, not, hey, it's a success if we get people off of welfare.
Right. What do you make of then this Trump? I mean, he's moving forward with his sort of dismantling, at least, or getting rid of portions of the Department of Education that don't really that are simply bureaucracy. How far do you think that's going to go? And if you were in charge, what would you be getting rid of?
If I was getting rid of things, I would pass a bill that would force states that accept federal educational dollars to bring true school choice to their schools within a couple of years, otherwise they'd lose that money. That's what I'd very specifically do. As far as Department of Education, the government is so involved in so many things, and realistically, we're not going to end that overnight. But that doesn't mean these things need to be done by the Department of Education, you know.
Right.
And I trust, you know, people of goodwill who are somewhat experts in this or well-versed in this area can look at this and through vigorous debate probably come up with some pretty good solutions.
Well, and I think there again, sort of results tend to speak for themselves. In general, I think even sort of the worst parents or some of the worst parents care about their kids being able to, at the very least, move out of the house when they're 18 and get a job, right? So what, you know, the whole point of education is for the kids to move out of the home and into their own home and into the workplace. And so if you have a school that is, you know, maybe not doing that, pretty soon parents figure that out and they don't send their kids. I'm going to the school choice idea, right? They don't send their kids to that school. And if you have yet another school that's doing that and you have the like voucher or whatever you want to call that, you can send your kids there, that school, it'll just grow. The results sort of speak for themselves. And then other people will say, well, shoot, I should take what they're doing here like they do in any kind of business, right? You come up with a cereal that everyone loves and pretty soon there are 300 other kinds of cereals out there. I mean, I think like you said, the market would take care of everything, right?
Oh yeah, in that freedom discovers the solution, right? You don't have to have this top down. I'm the boss. Here's the solution for this problem. The problem happens, and 100 people look at that problem and say, "How the heck can we solve that? How could I make some money by solving that? How can I be more successful? How can my kids learn quicker?" You know. Back to the education, just think about it. In your life, my lifetime, is there any single product, any product, that has retrograded or even stayed the same? I mean, look at the televisions today,
right,
of them.
Mm-hmm.
Look at technology. Look at anything, the quality of a computer, of a blender, of, you know, what you can get for $15. But education, you look at education and say, there's been no improvement since the 60s, you know?
Huh.
And really, like you said about the testing, you kind of have to trust the testing because a lot of people say it's actually been worse than the testing shows because they've dumbed down the tests so much. These aren't consistent tests over time where you have some timeline that you can truly look at. You know, they change the test and that just destroys all past data, really.
Right. Well, and the tests exist sort of for the tests themselves. I don't even go into trying to have somebody explain like the CMAS math test scores. At the end, you're like, what? You kind of think you understand it going in. Well, you know, what about you look at higher education and some of the things that Doge and Trump is discovering and I don't remember the specifics, but in looking at some of these giant Ivy League schools, and they were talking about these like millions and millions of dollars they had in like grants and foundations that they weren't touching, right? That was just, so somebody's making money somewhere there. And yet on the other hand, they're saying, oh, we need more federal money coming in. And then you're like, but you're charging people to go to the school. You're a private school. Help me get my head around what's going on there.
I think people never quoted, but I think it was Truman when he was talking about in his farewell speech about beware of the military-industrial complex, which everyone remembers. Mm-hmm. But he also said beware of the higher education and government nexus, or however he described it. He had the same exact warning about it,
right.
And that's basically what has happened. You know, these it's kind of an incestuous thing where you vote this way, money comes, you increase it. You know, I look at tuition. Let's look at college tuition. Just analyze it from a business perspective. Why has it increased faster than the rate of inflation for decades? What on their side, if you're an English student, tell me how the cost have increased in 50 years from an instruction standpoint, you know, other than maybe some high-tech things or some physics things where there's very huge expensive items, there's no reason for a lot of philosophies or studies.
Well, yeah, reading Catcher in the Rye is still, you saw it at Rev's, the high school he's going to be going to, Catcher in the Rye is one of the books. It's like, that's the same book as it was when I read it, right?
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't cost more. You cost the same, and, you know, we might use technology, but we don't really need to. And even that, how much can that cost when you divide it over, you know, 40 students or 400 students? So it's because of the way it works. As student loans increase, the colleges raise their tuition and suck it up. It's just a transfer of funds from the American people to them.
You're right. Yeah, that's true. And then back to then it gets paid. It's like, it's sort of like the Ukraine war, basically,
yep,
right?
Exactly.
It's all, as you said, whatever the industrial complex, that's how it works. Well, do you think it's going to make, just a couple more questions for you. I know this was now years ago, not that many years ago, but we did some stuff, some stories with, I think it was in Douglas County, where they were spending all of this money on these DEI programs. And so as a result of that, all of these people now were forming DEI training companies, right? That were charging exorbitant amounts of money to go in and teach people DEI stuff, right? I mean, it was sort of a build it and, you know, or put the money out there and they will build it. And so Trump is forcing people and school districts and organizations to cut back on that. Do you think it's going to have a lasting impact, or do you see these people saying, okay, I'm just going to hunker down here for the next like 3 years, or I'm going to call it something else? Or do you think that a lasting change can be made here?
I think that really depends on the citizens, if how deep their feelings go, because right now, right, the Dems poll at like 21% positive.
Right.
So of all these people who have, you know, come newbies that have come voting Republican and for Trump, if they can see the results and actually internalize, hey, this was a good choice, you know, cause and effect type thing, which people quite often aren't very good at cause and effect, but I think then it will definitely be a last. It will be something that can't be stopped. But on the other hand, if, you know, it's easy to go back to the way we were and the way we used to think and things like that. So I don't know. I will hope for the best.
Well, and I go back to, you know, again, just some of that. One of the reasons I was thinking of that is, so again, at Rev School, and he's going to go high school, Broomfield High School. I think it's going to be a great school. But he could sign up for languages, and one of the language was, and it didn't even occur to me, this is, you know, so you have German, Spanish, I think some Chinese, I think Russian, and then it was ALS. And I'm like, what's ALS? And they're like, Algerian? Or, you know, and somebody said, no, that's sign language. And I'm like, what? Sign language? And then, you know, you think of, though, all of these, they create these things. You know, you go to the Denver Broncos game and there's somebody down standing. You can't see him if you're in the stands, right, doing sign language for the national anthem, like people don't know the words. Or if you're watching it on TV, the words are there. I mean, it's just ludicrous. But now that's something they're teaching in the schools. That's an actual, I don't know,
they've
maybe it's just me, but
captioning.
To me that just seems ridiculous.
Everything has closed captioning on it. So yes, I laugh the same way when they're doing the sign language on TV. It's like, if you truly had this issue, you'd be have the reading the text anyhow.
Exactly. You would have that other. And so to me, it's, why are they teaching it in schools, right? Why do we need to be sending out all of these students who now are proficient in sign language? It's, I guess they could get jobs, you know, when people sing the national anthem. To me, it's just like, but that's got to be a DEI kind of thing, isn't it?
One would think, well, it's kind of like women's studies and African studies, these,
yes,
you know, gender studies. These aren't true scientific fields, you know, they're for indoctrination. You can tell that by the number of people who the types of people who, you know, populate the teaching staff.
Right, right. Well, it's crazy. Well, let me, John, just a final kind of final question for you. Do you, I mean, you know, as more and more it seems across the country, the whole idea of letting the parents have both the financial ability and the school choice, however that may break down, that seems, correct me if I'm wrong, that seems to be growing. Do you think?
Oh, it's definitely growing. It's not moving nearly fast enough. If you're you know, a relatively poor kid in this country, and your parents really aren't focused on your education, and you're depending on the public school you're going to, you're out of luck. I mean, it's sad. Like you mentioned earlier about the whole school where none of the third graders are proficient. That's about the age when most educators will say, if you're not performing at grade level, you never will. So basically what those kids are already so damaged, the odds are heavily against them that they will ever be able to perform at grade level. And grade level's not that tough. Come on.
No. Well, what do they say? Up until third grade, you learn to read. And then after third grade, you read to learn. And I think you're right. If by third grade, you haven't really learn to read, then everything you're reading after that, it's not you're not able to process it, right? Because you just can't read it, right?
Right. Well, and that's because this is a multi-generational issue that's been going on since at least the 60s. It's difficult to look solely to the parents, because a lot of parents might have good intentions, but they got a crappy education too. And if mom...
Right.
Had a crappy education, what's the odds she's going to have a book and read to her baby?
Right.
You know, very slim, probably because she has a poor command of the English language. So it's understandable. But because things got broken, it's going to take some effort to get things back in whack, as they might say.
Okay, Doug. Well, John, hey, listen, thank you for your time. You've got a couple columns up, let people know, on American Thinker. That's where most of your stuff is, right? American
Thinker? Yeah, right
Thinker?
Now they're the most susceptible, I guess.
All right. Well, sir, thank you for your time on this Wednesday. We sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Julie. You take care.
All right, John Conlon there. Check his columns out. I like it. Like you said, not being subtle here. Public school teachers, the stupidest creatures on the planet. Coming up on Friday, we're going to have Ash Epp with us. Ash has done a ton of work involving the election integrity and working, revealing and exposing things going on at the Secretary of State's office. And you'll be surprised to find out that one of the Jenna Griswold's main, I don't know what you would call him, he was sort of like the deputy there, right? He had to leave after that whole password scandal. Well, fortunately for us, somebody from the Brownstein Law Firm has been airdropped into the Secretary of State's office to start running things now. Ash has just some incredible stuff on that. And she also wanted to talk a little bit more about the COGOP chair race as well. But that's going to do it for us, being me, on this Wednesday. We will see everybody on Friday. Have a great couple of days.